First National Bank versus American Eurocopter. Must be some friends of yours. Wanted to see you in action. Mike, what was the big crowd doing here in June?
Students.
Huh?
Students, I think.
He thinks it's students. All right, Council.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the Court. I'd like to begin by addressing the distinction or difference between the general hazard of rotating helicopter blades, which the defendants have tried to focus on in the brief, and the specific latent hazard of blade flap on this Dauphin helicopter, which is what we think the case is all about. I think we can all agree that any conscious human being will generally appreciate the risk of putting your head in a plane of rotating blades. But
particularly if you've seen MASH.
Pardon?
Particularly if you're a student of MASH.
Yes. If you're a student of MASH, that's absolutely
right. You crawl
right.
up on your hands and knees, as near as I can tell.
But it's absolutely right. But this case does not involve MASH or the helicopter in MASH. It involves the Dauphin helicopter, which had a high set rotor, as you know from the record. It had an enclosed tail rotor, the Fenestron tail rotor, and it was enclosed for the safety of ground personnel. And it was marketed and used by busy executives and emergency personnel with the representation that it was safe to be on the ground so they could enter and exit while the blades were rotating. And what was not apparent to passengers, the Conseco passengers, and to Larry Inlow, was that there was a specific enhanced and latent defect known as blade flap, a latent hazard. And that blade flap is a phenomenon where the decelerating blades can flap down unexpectedly from their nominal height of 8 to 9 feet down to head height, so the height of a human being. And there's no evidence that Larry Inlow was aware of this latent hazard. And he, as well as all of the other Conseco employees, obviously thought that there was a safe way to enter and exit this helicopter while the blades were still rotating, because that's what they had done on many occasions for several years. And they did so because, as the record reflects, these defendants represented to Conseco's director of flight operations that the rotating blades on the Dauphin helicopter would not be a hazard to ground personnel. And by the way, that oral representation, which Mr. Rice testified to, is consistent with the defendant's marketing literature. And I think, where does that leave us? The district court below essentially conceded that the specific hazard of blade flap was not open and obvious to passengers like Larry Inlow. And if you look at page 38 of the district court's opinion, you see that concession. You'll see that the district court, in discussing the specific hazard of blade flap, says that although trained pilots may appreciate the risk, the same cannot be said about passengers. And the district court goes on to say that to appreciate the specific enhanced risk, one must have some understanding of aerodynamics and forces that affect the movement of rotor blades. So the district court basically concludes that this risk was not appreciated by Mr. Inlow, and that's why the district court went on to rely on this sophisticated intermediary doctrine, and did so in a way that we think was unprecedented, unjustified under the 1995 Indiana Product Liability Act, and did so in a way to basically excuse the defendant's admitted failure to warn. And I'd like to address basically the twofold error here. One is that, in our view, this common law sophisticated intermediary doctrine, if it ever existed in Indiana outside of the field of pharmaceutical product liability, did not survive the 1995 Indiana Product Liability Act. And the second point, related point, is that even if it did, the record is replete with contested issues of fact that preclude the entry of summary judgment based on the sophisticated intermediary doctrine. Our argument as to the 1995 Act is fairly straightforward, although it's an issue of first impression because the Indiana courts have not addressed this issue of whether the common law defense of sophisticated intermediaries survived the 1995 Act. And thus, I think it's incumbent really on this court to predict how the state's highest court would rule. As we said in our brief, we think that prediction can be made with a high degree of comfort based on the Indiana Supreme Court decisions in Kosky and Miller, Those decisions dealt with the 1978 Act, but those decisions, when read together, stand for the proposition that when the Indiana legislature decides to completely enter and preempt by way of statute the field of product liability, that the common law defenses disappear, and that the trial courts then must look to the language of the statute to identify the essential elements of the claim and the defenses thereto. As we point out, complete preemption occurred for the first time in Indiana in 1995 when the Indiana legislature overhauled the Product Liability Act and expressly stated that it now applied to all forms of product liability actions, whether it be strict liability, negligence, breach of warranty. And if our reading of Kosky and Miller is correct, that the preemption of strict liability in 1978 meant that the common law defenses to a strict liability claim fell away, then surely when the legislature entered the field of negligence claims in 1995, then the common law defenses disappeared as well. And if you accept the Kosky and Miller analysis and our preemption analysis, then the district court should not have been looking at those old sophisticated intermediary cases. It should have been looking at the statute. And if you look at the statute, Section 5.4 of the 95 Act, we see that the Indiana legislature specifically enumerated all of the defenses available to a defendant in a Product Liability Act, and we see that the legislature did not list a sophisticated intermediary defense. And obviously they could have, if they wanted to, expressed the idea that the duty, manufacturer's duty to warn, can be delegated to some third party or some intermediary. Instead, we see, from the plain language, a conscious policy choice to make the manufacturer's duty to warn non-delegable. Now, the defense in the brief have argued that, well, gee, the defense must have survived because there are some post-95 decisions that talk about it, but in fact all of those decisions rely on the versions of the Act prior to 1995. None of them address the issue we've raised here, but they are unanimous in one sense. They all emphasize that in those few instances where the Indiana courts have applied the sophisticated intermediary doctrine, they have expressly held that the application is, quote, almost always a question of fact for the jury. And that brings me to my next point, which is the contested fact. The defendants, in their brief, even admitted that the record contained contradictory evidence regarding the material issue of whether the pilots here knew about the specific enhanced hazard of blade flap. At page 22 of the brief, you'll see the concession. Quote, contradictory testimony was elicited from certain Conseco witnesses that they would not have allowed disembarkation while the main rotor was slowing if they had known that doing so presented a risk of blade strikes to departing passengers. And then if you look at the deposition testimony of the pilots, Deaton, Sexton, Soika, and Stedham, all of which are cited in our brief and all of which I reviewed this morning, they're all asked, did you know, did anybody tell you that the blade tips on the Dauphin helicopter could flap down on deceleration from the nominal height of 8 to 9 feet down to head height? And they all said no, they were not aware of that, they had not been warned of that. And I think that that's a logical conclusion, because any other conclusion would suggest that these pilots either had a murderous intent or that Mr. Inlow was suicidal.
So you don't agree with the district court when he said that all the Conseco pilots testified that they were aware of the risk that decelerating rotor blades could flex down and strike a person?
Yeah, the problem with I don't agree with it because it's a generalization, and the whole problem is this case is kind of tried on sound bites of depositions. I think if you look at that deposition testimony, there some of them are saying that from their military experience they were aware that on some types of helicopters there was blade flap, but when pressed about what they knew about the Dauphin with its high set rotor, with its enclosed Fenestron tail rotor, and what their practice was of letting the passengers enter and exit for a period of several years, they all said, I didn't know, we didn't appreciate it on this particular helicopter.
Judge Hamilton went on to say Deaton himself was uncomfortable with Conseco's deboarding policy. He would not have implemented that policy if it were up to him, and he'd complained about the policy to Conseco along with other pilots.
Yeah, there was some after the fact excuse making. I think the only point I'm going to say here is if you sort through all the testimony, you will see a conflict in the testimony. You will see some of the pilots saying, I didn't appreciate the risk. You'll see others saying, I trained at American Eurocopter. They never told me about the risk. In fact, when we trained, when we did the training flight, everybody was entering and exiting. You look at the American Eurocopter marketing literature, they expressly they say it's safe and intended for these kinds of things. So my only point is, a lot of people were deposed here. A lot of people said after the fact, oh yeah, I wouldn't have done that. But other people said, I didn't know at the time. And if they did know at the time, I mean, the inference is just horrendous that they were reckless or murderous. And that's not an inference that you can make against the Larry Inlow family here on this record on summary judgment. That's the point I want to make. You can sort through here. You can take a lot of sound bites. But if you take the inference in the light most favorable to the opposition here, then I don't think this is a summary judgment case. And I want to make I'm into my rebuttal. I'm going to make one more point before I sit down. The application of the learned intermediary doctrine is remarkable here because the essential element of the doctrine is set forth in the restatement of torts and in the Indiana cases is that you actually have to warn. And here this defendant has admitted that it did not warn. And unfortunately, the district court was not too concerned about that because the district court went off and said, well, okay, constructive notices is sufficient. Well, there's one Indiana case, the natural gas case, that discusses whether constructive notice is satisfactory, and the natural gas appellate court says strongly that the Indiana court should not rely on constructive notice where the dangers or the hazards are severe. So we think the district court made a legal error there in excusing actual notice and extending the doctrine to constructive notice. So I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Hugh Cost for the Appellees, American Eurocopter and Eurocopter. If I may, I'd like to start with the legal issues. We were accused, or we were taking the task in the reply brief for having only spent five paragraphs on the open and obvious preemption issue, and quite frankly, I think it was six paragraphs. We have felt that no more was necessary, but at this point I will expand on the points made in our opposition brief and our appellee's brief. First of all, the estate's false premise that the 1978 Act, as interpreted by Kosky and Miller, did not cover negligence claims, that's a premise they still have not cleaned up or acknowledged in their reply. In fact, the 1978 Act did cover negligence and strict liability claims, as did the 1995 Act under which this case arises. In addition, in Kosky, which held preempted the open and obvious danger rule in the context of strict liability claims, found expressly a clear intention by the Indiana legislature to preempt the field of strict liability in the 1978 Act. It relied on the codification and restatement language that was used at that time in the 1978 Act. There was no such codification and restatement language in the 1995 revisions, which are applicable to this case. Kosky recognized the need to for an unmistakable intention in order for the preemption of common law principles to apply under Indiana law. That is a rule that is expressed clearly in Kosky. It's also a rule expressed in a Seventh Circuit case, Anderson versus Radice, which we cited for a different proposition. Again, an unmistakable intention. The estate doesn't cite or discuss the Miller case once in its reply. And the Miller case is probably the central case here. It is the case that held under the 78 Act that the open obvious defense was not preempted, that the common law defense was not preempted. That case is not discussed in the reply. If the estate's position were correct, Miller would have to be overruled. There is no intention in the enactment of the 1995 revisions by the Indiana legislature to overrule Miller, and presumptively they knew of Miller, which had been on the books for some time. In fact, the estate doesn't cite any legislative history whatsoever from the 1995 revisions to show an intention on the part of the Indiana legislature to preempt the field.
Part of the reason is Indiana doesn't have legislative history.
Not per se. I understand that, Your Honor. The other thing we do point out in a footnote in our brief, and it is pulled up as a straw man as being the principal part of our argument, and that is that the 1995 amendments were tort reform. They were designed to make certain types of claims, design defect claims and failure to warn claims, into negligence claims rather than strict liability claims. It seems anomalous to us that an enactment intended to circumscribe tort liability would eliminate defenses, especially without a clear indication of such. In the event that the preemption argument is carried over to the sophisticated intermediary arena, that would also require an overruling of both the Smock case and the Ritchie case, the Smock case being an Indiana appellate court case and the Ritchie case being a case decided by this court. Both, contrary to what the estate argues, were decided under the 1995 Act, Product Liability Act. Since the 10-year, in the 10 years, almost 10 years since the passage of the 1995 revisions, we haven't found a single case, and none has been cited to the court, holding the preemption to have occurred, as argued by the estate. Not a single case. We have several cases, including Smock and Ritchie, that address the sophisticated intermediary doctrine and continue to apply it, if you will. We've also cited to the court the Burt case, the Rogers case, and more recently the Hughes case. We had a miscite between Burt and Rogers, for which I apologize, Your Honors. It was a transposition of the site. In fact, the quoted language in our papers appears in Rogers versus Costco. Burt quoted part of the language, not all of the language, but we acknowledge that Burt was quoting Rogers. Rogers, in fact, is not dicta as characterized by the estate, and a cursory reading of that opinion lets us know that. So again, Rogers, Burt, the more recent Hughes case out of the Southern District, Smock, and Ritchie all applied, continued to apply the common law defenses under the 1995 Act. Discussing the sophisticated intermediary doctrine itself, it has been applied. The case law does recognize expressly both in Indiana and this court's cases interpreting Indiana law make clear that it does apply outside of the medical devices and pharmaceutical context in appropriate circumstances. These cases also make very plain that no warning by the manufacturer is necessary in the case of actual or constructive knowledge on the part of the intermediary. In our case, we don't need to reach constructive knowledge. We had actual admitted knowledge on the part of the intermediary. I'd like to also just point out again, as we did in our papers, that the state has not cited a single case that holds the manufacturer liable for the obvious dangers associated with propellers and rotors. Not a single case. It also has not cited a single case where a manufacturer of an aircraft was not allowed to rely on professional commercial FAA certificated pilots to properly interface and control passengers and the aircraft related to passenger safety. If I could address briefly some of the factual issues or purported factual issues. Again, we had professional trained FAA certificated pilots. They have roundly admitted that they knew of a danger of disembarking passengers from this helicopter and other helicopters when the blades
were. They were all aware of the fact that there was a blade that reduced itself from above the head to down to 5 feet two or thereabouts. They were all aware of that.
Your Honor. They were unaware, they testified that they were unaware specifically of the 5 foot 2 inch issue. Of course, that data came from a Coast Guard study It was a completely different operational scenario involving full rotor RPM, full speed, and cyclic, which tilts the disc of the rotor full forward. Here we had blades not under power, and we had cyclic and neutral according to the pilot. More importantly, Your Honors, 5'2", 5'3", 4'4", completely irrelevant. The point is...
Well, I agree if you're over 5'4".
Every one of these pilots testified, in particular the accident pilot and the accident co-pilot testified, that they knew there was a danger of disembarkation with rotors slowing, decelerating. They knew that. They knew it was especially dangerous in the front of the aircraft where Mr. Inlow had been struck. Whether it's going to hit you in the head or hit you in the chest is irrelevant. The danger to appreciate is that it can cause bodily injury or death. And they have all testified that they knew that. They used words like dangerous. They said it was not safe. It was a common concern. It was discussed with management and it was rejected. Some of the pilots did know of this blade flap phenomenon. Others didn't, but still knew that it could hit you. Again, we're talking about the risk to appreciate. We could not deliver an aerodynamic lecture with every helicopter, so to speak. The point is, they knew it was dangerous, particularly in the front of the helicopter. Mr. Inlow walked there before and had specifically been told, don't walk there, at least on one occasion, that the blades almost hit him.
Don't go there, Larry, I think was what the holler was.
That's correct. His passage while heading towards the front of the aircraft had been impeded on several occasions, precisely because of the danger. Seconds, literally seconds before he was struck, the co-pilot walks around the front of the aircraft to open the door, and he, in his words, hugs the nose. And he did that, he had a subjective belief seconds before the accident that that was a dangerous area. The district court amply quoted the accident pilot. He was uncomfortable with it. He would have done it differently had he been in charge. There was another near miss involving another individual as well in front of the aircraft. As we set forth in our brief, the danger is widely publicized in industry literature. There's an OSHA regulation on point. It's a regulatory declared risk, if you will. And pilots also characterized it as common sense, obvious, and an intuitive risk. Michael Cauliflower, the other passenger on the aircraft for the very first time, knew it immediately without being told. And remarkably, these admissions do not appear in the briefs filed by the estate. None of them. And they didn't appear in the briefing filed by the estate in the district court. But the district court did set forth all this evidence in its entry. Certain factual points regarding how the accident occurred. The estate had one version in its opening brief with no citation to the record. It now has a second version in its reply, and it cites Mr. Cauliflower. But on supplemental appendix page 59, Mr. Cauliflower states unequivocally he didn't see where Mr. Inlow was struck. The estate's version from Cauliflower is truncated. The estate points to a lot of testimony that my clients did not warn the pilots, or that my clients did not warn the pilots of blade flap, or that my clients did not warn the pilots of 5'2". But again, they knew, they appreciated very plainly the risk of serious injury or death.
How long had your pilots been on that plane, or a plane of that nature?
The Conseco pilots?
Two that were involved on that given day.
Yes. They had owned the aircraft for 5 years prior to the accident, and I believe both Mr. Deaton and Mr. Soika had been there for over 2 years each.
Flying.
Mr. Soika, I think, for a slightly shorter time than Mr. Deaton. Mr. Deaton testified that he knew of the issue of blade flap from the military years before. The marketing materials, they're still being championed in the reply brief. The most fervently championed, when you're ready to unload, passengers can move around the aircraft safely and confidently. It is uncontroverted that that document did not reach Conseco until after the accident. The pilots have all testified that they had not seen the marketing material, that they would not fly an aircraft based on marketing material in all events. And again, there is a lot of word games, if you will, a ruse. The briefs filed by the estate speak about rotating blades. They talk about marketing flights occurring with rotating blades and deboarding with rotating blades. Very different than blades decelerating. That's a critical distinction here. And that's been testified to, again, by all of these pilots. One other tangential issue. The safe way to do it. If there was a safe way to deboard this aircraft, it was at 90 degrees of beam. That had been done for the 5 years in question. The pilots testified that even that was dangerous, but they did it. If Mr. Inlow thought there was a safe way to do it, that was the way. When he one time went to the front of the aircraft, he was warned specifically not to. So to the extent that there was a safe way to do it, it wasn't followed on this day. Regarding the contradictory testimony, I would simply point out, Your Honor, that it was a poor choice of wording on my part. There is really no contradictory testimony here. There may be some self-contradictions by some of the pilots, but those self-contradictions, as is amply set forth in our brief, do not, under the law, preclude summary judgment. In addition to which, my further... Excuse me, Your Honor. My time is...
If you need another minute, take it.
Thank you. My further review of that testimony is really that it's not self-contradictory, because it says things like, my clients didn't warn, not we didn't know. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will say in summary that a lot of liberties have been taken with sound bites. As for what the pilots know, I'll just give you a couple of examples. Here's Mr. Soika, who was one of the pilots, and this is at Supplemental Appendix 0311. Question, in your training in Grand Prairie, Texas, which is where the AEC training, had you ever received information relating to how low the main rotor blades could travel? No. Question, so you had not received notice from American Eurocopter about how low the main rotor blades would travel? Is that a first statement? Answer, yes, it is. Here's Mr. Stedham, one of the other pilots. Have you ever read or seen anything that told you the blades could flex down 2 feet below from their static position? Answer, no. Question, did you ever see any warnings from Eurocopter or Aerospatiale or American or Aerospatiale Helicopter Corporation that said the blades could flex down to 2 feet from their static position in front of the helicopter? No, I don't recall seeing any of that. Here's what Mr. Wright said, who is the director of flight operations at Conseco. Question, did you ask anybody about whether or not in the dynamic situation there would be the blades could go below that 9.34 feet? Answer, did I ask if the blades could go below 9.34? The answer would be no, but what I did ask is do they represent a danger to workers around there and the passengers and that sort of thing, and the implication was no, it's a high-set rotor. And he goes on to say that he understood from the descendants that it was safe for the ground people to be on. So there is, contrary to my counsel's argument that we're talking about, you know, 5 foot two or 4 foot eight, that's just not the case. These pilots said they were not aware that these blades could tip down to human height, otherwise they wouldn't have let anybody out. These were not reckless people, they were trained, experienced pilots. And I'll also say just one final point on where Mr. Inlow was. If you look at Mr. Soika's testimony, the pilot, as well as Mr. Cauliflower, you will see that Mr. Soika, the pilot, says he saw Mr. Inlow proceeding straight out at a 90-degree angle. Mr. Cauliflower says Mr. Inlow never got out in front of the pilot. So even on that issue, there's a contested issue of fact. And what we have here is counsel taking little sound bites from certain depositions. And I don't think as I said at the outset, this is just, it's just inconceivable that this kind of case with the Indiana precedent would get thrown out of court on summary judgment. And I also want to note that, you know, this whole notion about Smock and the Ricker decision relying on the continuation of the Indiana Product Liability Act, it's just not true, because if you look at those cases, they both cite the natural gas odorizing case, and here's what natural gas odorizing said. They rely only on natural gas odorizing for their discussion of the learned intermediary doctrine or sophisticated intermediary doctrine. Here's what natural gas odorizing says. Quote, since the initiation of the Downs lawsuit, the Indiana Product Liability Act has been amended substantially. However, our analysis is based on the act as it read prior to the 1995 amendment. So I think that this argument that Indiana courts are still applying the doctrine post-95 is not supported by a review of the decisions that they relied on.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. We will take the case under